Welcome everybody to Pulmonary Pathology Journal Club. This is June 30th, 2025, discussing articles from May 2025. Glad you can all join us today. You know, it's a holiday week, so I know folks are busy, but it's nice that we have at least a few here to listen into the discussion. So May 2025 was a little bit of slim pickings, I have to admit. There were so I'm only going to discuss three articles today, but there were some interesting articles, and in particular the first one that I want to spend most of the time on. And for those of you who have access to the Dropbox or are pulling this up, this is an article from Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, this with first author Amanda Lindberg, senior author Karina Strell. In situ detection of PD-1 and PD-L1 interactions as a functional predictor for response to immune checkpoint inhibition in non-small cell lung cancer, from Journal of Thoracic Oncology. As all of us know who are involved in signing out PD-L1s, the correlation between PD-L1 status as determined by the tumor, the total, what is it, the TPS score, the tumor proportion score, and actual response to immune checkpoint inhibition is not very good, depending on the clinical study that you read. Some stuff suggests that it can be predictive of response to therapy, but there are a lot of non-responders who have high expression of PD-L1, and then people who have low expression of PD-L1 who actually do respond to immune checkpoint inhibition. And it's been hypothesized by others that perhaps we're not actually looking at the right thing when we're analyzing PD-L1, because what is really required for that those drugs to work is to interrupt the interaction between PD-1 on the T cell and PD-L1 that's expressed by the tumor cell. I hope I have that correct and not backwards. But anyway, that interaction is what slows down the immune response. And so blockade of that interaction will unleash the immune response and take the brakes off, so to speak. But in order for that drug to work, there has to be an interaction. If there is no interaction, then there's nothing to interrupt. And so others have hypothesized that maybe the actual thing that we should be looking for to assess whether or not immune checkpoint inhibition will be effective is to assess for the interaction between those two molecules and not simply expression of PD-1 or PD-L1. And others in several other published papers have looked at PD-1 and PD-L1 together through different types of assays, co-localization assays, fancy types of techniques to see if evidence can be found of interaction between them and whether or not that can be predictive of response to therapy. But what these authors did, which I think is really clever, I want to show the technique they've used, rather than using co-localization assays and fancy techniques, they developed an assay that can be used in clinical materials with simple light microscopy that can assay for the presence of an interaction between PD-1 and PD-L1, sort of a standard laboratory way with standard instrumentation that most of us have access to. And to explain it further, I just want to bring up their figure one so you can see the diagram of the how the assay works. And let me just share my screen for those of you who may not have the paper in front of you. Let's see if this works. Can you see my screen? Hopefully.
Yes.
So the technique that they used is called a proximity ligation assay, PLA. And these have been used in the past to in sort of an investigational way to look for interactions between two things. And what's clever about this one, this is a second generation proximity ligation assay. And what you do in this, you use two different primary antibodies, one for PD-L1 and one for PD-1. And those two primary antibodies are from different species. And then you use secondary antibodies that are species specific to bind to the one or the other. And then each of these secondary antibodies is linked to what they called an unfold sequence. Basically, it's a sequence of nucleic acid that's covalently bound to those two antibodies that they're designed to interact with each other, but they'll only interact with each other if they're in close proximity to each other. So if the two targets are very, very close or interacting with each other, then the antibodies will bind in those locations that are very, very near each other. And then the nucleic acid sequences that are bound to these secondary antibodies will be able to interact with each other. They stay folded up like this until you use an enzyme digestion to unfold them. And when they are unfolded after enzyme digestion, they'll bind to each other in this circular pattern. And then you can amplify using a process they call, let me get it right here. Let's see, RCA, sorry. I want to get this right. Rolling circle amplification, RCA. So rolling circle amplification, this circle of nucleic acid will form, and then you can amplify this over and over and over again in a circle, only at the sites where that interaction has been able to occur because of proximity. And then you amplify it, and then you use an alkaline phosphatase with an oligonucleotide that can then bind to those circles and then produce your signal that you can then see by light microscopy. If you look now at panel B, they show some examples of this. So this is, I don't remember what kind of carcinoma this is, but they're showing here basically the IHC signals from PD-L1 and PD-1. And this is sort of the conventional way of looking at things that we're all familiar with. And then PLA, here's the proximity ligation assay. And in this case, they used a red chromogen. So you can see these little red dots. And these red dots are presumably the locations where PD-L1 and PD-L1 are close enough that they are presumably interacting with each other and then producing the actual interaction signal, if you want to think of it that way. And then they used digital analysis to be able to detect these interactions and figure out the location where those interactions are occurring, in which cells they're occurring, and quantify them and all that kind of stuff. I won't go into all the details here, but that's the basic way that the assay works. And so once they have this assay, they then were able to ask questions about whether or not this interaction score, as determined by this technology, would actually be predictive of response to immune checkpoint inhibition, which is really neat because this type of assay could be used in any surgical pathology laboratory, just like we use our PD-L1 immunohistochemistry. But if it works better in terms of prediction of therapy, then maybe we should be doing this instead of our PD-L1s. So to get at this, what they did first is they took 352 surgically resected cases of malignancy from patients who were immune checkpoint inhibitor naive, who had not been treated. Actually, they were non-small cell lung cancer cases. And then they subjected them to this assay to see how many of them displayed evidence of interactions. It turns out that not every case, as it was not totally surprising, not every case had expression of both markers. So some cases don't have expression of PD-L1 or PD-1 or whatever. But of the cases that did display detectable PD-L1 and PD-1 expression, defined as at least 1% of the cells each, those that had detectable protein of both, only 54% of them exhibited evidence of interaction. Which I think is not that surprising because that's kind of our clinical experience with PD-L1 expression and how people respond to PD-L1 directed therapy. Some of them do respond and they have expression, and some of them don't. But in this, with this assay, only about half of patients that display expression of both markers will actually have evidence of interaction occurring. So then they went on to further explore this. So the next thing I did was they developed an interaction score based on digital analysis and then saw whether or not it correlated with immune phenotypes. They don't have figures of this, but in the long results section, they talk about how they looked at CD3 and CD20 and CD4 and CD8 and then saw whether or not the interaction scores correlated with the immune cells that were present within the tissues. And they did see that a high interaction score correlated with an inflamed tumor phenotype. So more inflammation correlated with a higher interaction score, which I think is not that surprising. But interestingly, the strongest association was with high interaction scores and those tumors having high CD8 positive scores, lots of CD8 positive T cells. Then they correlated those findings with mutation status in the tumors. Interestingly, high PD-1, PD-L1 interaction scores were associated with lower, they were lower or less frequently observed in tumors that were EGFR mutated, with no differences seen in KRAS mutated tumors or TP53 mutated tumors. They did differential gene expression analysis. They tested a little over 1,900 genes and compared the upper quarter of interaction scores and the lower quarter of interaction scores to see what genes were differentially expressed. And interestingly, they found 56 genes that were differentially expressed between those two groups, the highest quartile and the lowest quartile of interaction scores. And high expression of markers of T cell activation were seen with high PD-L1, PD-1 interaction scores, and high expression of markers of T cell exhaustion, interestingly, were also seen when you had high interaction scores. They list genes that are in those two groups. It's mostly alphabet soup to me, but a few of them, high expression of markers of T cell exhaustion included PD-L1 and CTLA-4, which we know are important therapeutic targets for immune checkpoint inhibition. And then they did survival analysis, and patients with very low PD-1, PD-L1 interaction scores survived shorter than those who had higher scores with univariate analysis. Unfortunately, that did not stand up to multivariate analysis. But at least it provides early data that this interaction score does have some clinical meaning, at least as it relates to patient survival in the treatment naive setting. Then they moved on to evaluate expression in different tumor types, or I'm sorry, not expression, but the presence of PD-1, PD-L1 interactions. And that's here in figure two. So in part B here, you can see all the different tumors that were tested. They said they tested 2 to 15 tumors per tumor type, and it included most of the common malignancies, lung carcinoma, melanoma, colorectal carcinoma, pancreatic carcinoma, endometrial carcinoma, hepatocellular carcinoma, breast carcinoma, et cetera, et cetera. And you can see here the percent positive cells that were interacting varied widely among different malignancy types. So, for example, breast cancers had low interaction levels, but there were high PD-1, PD-L1 interaction levels observed in melanoma, lung carcinoma, particularly testicular cancer. And that is interesting because it aligns with what we know in terms of response to immune checkpoint inhibition across common human malignancies, that those drugs tend to work better for melanoma or lung cancer than they do for hepatocellular carcinoma, breast carcinoma. Again, suggesting maybe there's something to this, that actually the interaction score is meaningful. At least this correlates with the clinical behavior. And then the next thing they did, they took 133 immune checkpoint inhibitor treated patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer, and they looked at survival and how that correlated with PD-1, PD-L1 interactions with this assay. And so here you can see in this figure in the upper left here, these are immune checkpoint inhibited ICI treated non-small cell lung cancers, and how they stratified in terms of survival based on the proximity ligation assay score. So the interaction score, either high or low, and you can see there's a significant difference in survival, that assay does actually stratify patients quite well. And then treatment naive or control cases of non-small cell lung cancer, there was no significant difference between the two groups as defined by this assay. And then I think what's interesting here is they then went on to look at survival in the same groups with just with the PD-L1 IHC, like we do every day in our practices. So on the left is survival with PD-L1 tumor proportion scores of at least 1% and less than 1%. And you can see that in the ICI treated patients, at least in their cohort, PD-L1 expression alone by IHC, just the stuff we do every day, does not actually separate the two groups are not separated. In other words, the PD-L1 score is meaningless from a survival perspective in treated patients who have immune checkpoint inhibition. And then the graph here on the lower right are the ICI treated patients with non-small cell lung cancer who have PD-L1 scores greater or less than 50%. So we use this two cutoffs clinically, at least 1% or 50% and higher, as defining sort of the two groups as high PD-L1 expressors or those who have virtually any PD-L1 expression. And neither cutoff provided any statistical difference in survival, or were not predictive of survival in these treated patients. So I think these lower two panels correspond relatively well with what we are seeing in the data about the predictive value of PD-L1 immunohistochemistry and in terms of survival. And of course, this isn't consistent with all studies, but we know that the predictive value of PD-L1 expression in non-small cell lung cancer is, you know, modest at best. And this new type of assay that actually looks at the interactions between PD-1 and PD-L1, at least in this cohort, seems to be a much better predictor of survival after immune checkpoint inhibition, which I think is pretty exciting, particularly given the fact that this assay could be used in very easily in most standard anatomic pathology laboratories. Here's the survival analysis shown in a little bit different way with complete responders, partial responders, stable disease and progressive disease in the different colors from white to dark charcoal gray, showing again the difference between low interaction score folks and high interaction score folks. There in panel E, you can see that those who have a higher level of evidence of PD-1, PD-L1 interaction are much shifted towards complete or partial responses with immune checkpoint inhibition. And these differences are not as great when you're simply assaying for PD-L1 expression by IHC. So the last thing that they did, which they don't have a nice figure for, so I'll stop sharing my screen. But the last thing they did was compare molecular characteristics of the patients with high interaction levels stratified by the responses to immune checkpoint inhibitors, and then also the molecular characteristics of non-responders to immune checkpoint inhibition, stratified by interaction status and using a differential gene expression analysis approach. And what they saw was folks who do not respond to immune checkpoint inhibition, despite having high levels of PD-1, PD-L1 interaction with this assay. Why didn't they respond, even though it appeared that they should have, because they had a high level of interaction of those molecules? Well, they observed additional expression of stromal immune mediators that would potentially dampen the immune response. So it's, as we know, the immune system is complex, and it's not as simple as PD-1, PD-L1 interaction. And there are other molecules or other signaling pathways that modulate the immune response, and depending upon the immune milieu, the effectiveness of interrupting PD-1 and PD-L1 interaction in patients with malignancies can be different. So take home from this, I thought this was a pretty exciting, innovative approach to evaluating something that's probably more biologically relevant in terms of immune checkpoint inhibition, the actual interaction between PD-1 and PD-L1, with an assay that might be readily implemented in most clinical laboratories, at least in developed countries. But we'll have to see if this pans out and if it makes its way into actual clinical practice. Any comments about this? I don't know if anybody has seen this before. I personally was not familiar with this type of proximity assay, but it seems like it works. I'd love to play around with it.
You know, I was wondering, I'm just a simplistically saying, I always wondering if there's no plus the lymphocytes on site and how the PD, the ICI will work, you know? So you said the CD8 positive cell correlates really well. Did they compare the performance just simply looking at the, you know, the presence of a CD8 positive cells per se, you know? I mean, that's a simpler than additional, I mean, in a way, I mean, the technique you showed seems to be doable, but even easier is just, you know, looking at the just T cells. So yeah, in a way we do it, you know, see the CPS thing, you know, although they are looking at the PD-L1 expression in the cells in the background. But so, you know, I always wondering about those tumors, even if they're high PD-L1 expression, you know, there's no lymphocytes on site, you know, how it's gonna work. I guess it can always be recruited, but
that's a great comment. And I, you know, the devil's always in the details, right? And the one thing that they haven't done here, at least if I, maybe there's something that I missed, it's a very dense paper with a lot going on, but they looked for the relationship of high interaction scores with the presence of, you know, CD8, CD4, CD20 and CD3, but what they didn't do is look at any correlation between that interaction score, how it compared with, you know, not just total or a tumor proportion score, but, you know, the combined score that includes immune cells, like is done in other organ systems. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot still that isn't answered here, I think, with this particular assay that needs to be done to really bring it to prime time, but I think it's an exciting technology, an interesting way of getting at something that I think I haven't really thought about clinically. But we'll see. No, it's a great comment. And the other, Joanne, the other thing I noticed is, you know, I didn't get into this, but the way that they actually evaluated the interaction score and where they do get a little bit into this in the paper, where they looked at interactions that that were in the tumor, what they called the tumor compartment and then the stromal compartment. And they saw a stronger correlation with outcome data with interaction scores in the stromal compartment versus the tumor compartment, which I don't know exactly what that means, because in my mind, the interactions between the stromal component and the tumor, did they see at the interface between them, the interface between immune cells and the tumor cells themselves, and you know, there's immune cells within the sprinkled within the tumor, but what do interaction scores mean if they're not admixed with the tumor itself, but only in the stroma with the immune cells in the stroma? And so, and that was the more meaningful site of interaction with this, at least based on their data. So it's not perfect. So I guess I would expect this is going to produce, you know, offshoot papers and more work. You know, there's questions still to be answered about it, but any more comments about this? Well, if not, I will move on to article number 2 then. These other two articles I thought were not nearly as exciting. I guess that's my personal commentary about them. They're much simpler studies, but I think they're interesting and worthy of talking about. So the first one is, or you know, paper number 2 is from Virchow's archive, coming from Germany. The first author is Kanen, Christina Kanen. Diagnostic relevance of P53 and RB status in neuroendocrine tumors grade 3 from different organs. Immunohistochemical study of 465 high-grade neuroendocrine neoplasms. And what this study really was designed to get at was to look at expression of P53 and RB1 and whether or not it could be used to separate WHO grade 3 neuroendocrine tumors from high-grade neuroendocrine carcinomas. And we all know that there are those the tricky cases of large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma that are hard to distinguish from grade 3 NETs. And then, of course, for us lucky enough to practice thoracic pathology, we don't even have the luxury of having that distinction in our classification system, that grade 3 NETs are subsumed under the broader category of large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma, or at least they currently are, despite increasing data that maybe they are. They're different. They're different from a molecular standpoint, and probably from a molecular genetic standpoint and clinical standpoint. And we'll see if that holds up in the next iteration of the WHO classification scheme. But these authors wanted to look at P53 and RB1 and using a large cohort of high-grade neuroendocrine neoplasms, both grade 3 NETs and LCNECs and small cell carcinomas from a variety of anatomic sites. So they got 465 cases representing 9 different organ systems. They had 160 some odd GI cases. They had 120 pancreas neuroendocrine tumors. There were 70 from the lungs, 3 from the thymus, and 2 from the mediastinum, for those of us who like mediastinal things. They had about 35 head and neck tumors, about the same number of GYN tumors. They had some presacral and skin ones, and they had about 65 that were of unknown primary. And they basically reviewed all cases again in a blinded fashion, blinded to P53 and RB status. They just re-reviewed all the cases and classified them as either grade 3 neuroendocrine tumor by using current GI criteria, even for those tumors that were in different sites, like in the lung, that are not yet defined as such, but they used the GI criteria to call them grade 3 NETs versus large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma versus small cell carcinoma. And for any cases that they didn't have consensus on, and they met around a multi-headed scope and figured out what they wanted to call them and arrived at consensus. So once they had their cohort of 465, then they subjected them all to P53 and RB1 immunohistochemistry. And I'll show the patterns that they illustrate. Let me just share my screen here real quick. So I think this shouldn't come as any surprise, but the top row here is P53. So on the upper left is P53 wild type. And anybody who practices GYN pathology, this should be very familiar to you. So wild type is with a sprinkling of positive, moderately staining positive cells and a background of negative cells and sort of a mixture. And then there are two abnormal patterns, the null type with complete loss of expression of P53 with intact internal control, positive cells, endothelial cells, etc. And then a strong diffuse P53 pattern consistent with a TP53 mutation. So either a null type or diffuse, those are both abnormal expression patterns versus the normal wild type pattern in the upper left. And then RB1 is shown in the lower three panels. So normal is either scattered weakly to moderately staining cells or strongly diffusely positive cells. So these two patterns are normal RB1 and then RB1 complete loss of expression here in panel F. That's the abnormal RB1. So for those who aren't familiar with those two stains, that's how they're interpreted, and that's how they interpret them in the study. So they went through and stained them all and tabulated the results of all of those. Stop sharing now. And actually, let me share again. Sorry. I'll show you the results in their graphs better than me just talking. So this is the take home here. This is the distribution of P53 and RB status in their various groups. So I forgot to mention, they also stained a group of grade 1 or grade 2 neuroendocrine tumors as sort of a control. So on the left is grade 1 and 2 neuroendocrine tumors, then grade 3 neuroendocrine tumors, then large cell NECs, and then small cell NECs. And then the blue bars here are wild type status for both. The orange bars are abnormal P53 only, or abnormal P53, sorry. And then the green bar is abnormal RB. So you can see in grade 1 neuroendocrine tumors, almost all of them have wild type for both markers. When you get to grade 3 neuroendocrine tumors, there's a few more cases that actually have abnormal P53 and or RB, but most of them still have wild type status for both. And then when you get over to large cell neuroendocrine small cell carcinoma, most of those will have abnormal patterns with P53 and or RB, with only a few of them showing wild type pattern. They then looked at that same distribution by anatomic site. So this graph here, I don't know if you can see this top one, this is grade 3 neuroendocrine tumors. And you can see most anatomic sites are similar, GI tract, pancreas, thorax, et cetera, most of them are wild type with a few having P53 and or RB mutations or abnormal expression patterns, except for the head and neck. And head and neck tumors are a little bit different for whatever reason, and there's a higher proportion of abnormal P53 expression in those, in grade 3 neuroendocrine tumors of the head and neck. And then when you look at large cell neuroendocrine carcinomas, most of them show a similar pattern, with most of them not showing wild type expression, most of them having P53 and or RB1 expression that's abnormal, except for the head and neck. Again, the head and neck is an anomaly here, with some LCNECs of the head and neck having wild type patterns for both, a higher proportion of them than for all the rest of the anatomic sites. And then small cell carcinomas are pretty similar across the board. So almost all of them show abnormal P53 and abnormal RB1 status. So the take-home message from this, it really illustrates the, I think, the potential diagnostic utility of P53 and RB1 if you're struggling to distinguish between a grade 3 neuroendocrine tumor and a large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma. Those stains could be helpful, although you have to bear in mind that it's not perfect. So some large cell neuroendocrine carcinomas will have wild type pattern, and some grade 3 neuroendocrine tumors can have abnormal patterns in one or both. So there, again, this is a tricky area, and I think we're going to continue to see more work on these, and hopefully we'll get to the point where we can have more reliable criteria to distinguish them from each other, and maybe different diagnostic terms in the lung. We certainly see those in our consultation practice, those things that look like a carcinoid, but they have too much proliferation, look like a carcinoid, they look like an NET, something that I would call grade 3 NET in the GI tract any day of the week. I'd be curious to hear from the group how many folks are routinely doing P53 and RB1 on their high-grade neuroendocrine tumors. Are you guys doing that up in Rochester or over in Michigan?
Yeah, we do at Michigan. I think we've started, if there is a question, if it's small cell or maybe something else, RB and P53 can be really helpful. But yeah, this is something, yeah, the grade three question that we also want to parse out too, hopefully, given it seems like lung is the last holdout of all the organ systems.
I use RB occasionally, but not P53.
Yeah, me too. I rely heavily on Ki-67. So if it is over 50, then I will just bear toward the like large high grade site, So the Ki and the RB1, that's my crutches.
Kelly, what are you doing in Vermont? If you don't mind me putting on you on the spot. Maybe she's probably on frozen right now. So, all right. Any other comments about this paper? Maybe I should start doing P53. I think my approach has been a little bit like Henry's. I'll do RB1 sometimes, but not. Probably not as often as I should, but maybe I should be doing them just so that I could get a good feel of this and how they might be diagnostically useful in my practice.
By the way, is the new WHO working on this at all? I mean, I haven't heard the next generation will reflect the this obvious, thing that we are
I would love
lacking.
to know the answer to that. I'm not part of
Yeah.
that inner
Henry,
circle,
do you know
so and
anything
I haven't
about?
heard.
No,
No?
I don't know anything. I haven't heard anything either.
Yeah.
I wasn't near as heavily involved this on this last one as I was in some prior ones. So I don't even know, when it's supposed to come out. No idea.
That's right. We are not even working on new generation, I mean, new edition at all. So, oh well.
I thought
Let me
that
email
the one.
Natasha and find out if she knows. She undoubtedly knows.
I thought
Natasha Reed.
Brandon, sorry,
No, go ahead, Henry.
the image that you showed of the P50, no, RB, I didn't know that that you could also have RB that kind of looks like the P53 wild type, right, with some cells staining and some cells not. So in addition to everything else you presented, I thought that was useful. I didn't know that because I just thought it was all there or not. So the fact that there's a wild type that has some cell staining, right? Did I read that
Yeah,
right? Or yeah, that was
exactly
helpful.
right.
I didn't know that, so thanks.
And I think one of the challenges I find with RB that they don't really talk about is I use RB1 in soft tissue pathology too, and when I use it, I find it to be really challenging to interpret. You can almost interpret it whatever however you want to interpret it. You can decide that it's lost or not when it's sort of weak and there's a little bit there, but is it really lost or is it not actually lost and is it wild type? And I think it's a difficult stain to interpret when you really need it. It's easy when you don't actually need it, but when you really need it to make these distinctions, find it to not be all that reliable, but that's just my personal experience with it. I don't know if others have a different experience. Maybe it's different from lab to lab.
Yeah, I see that often.
Yeah, same experience often, here.
Occasionally see it for sure.
All right, thanks. Well, in the last 3 minutes, I'll move on to our final paper. This just really quickly, this is a paper from Memorial. Senior author is Jen Souter. First author is Rachel Fanaroff. This is from Modern Pathology, Correlation of Histologic Features with Gene Alterations in Pleural Mesothelioma. This is a pretty straightforward case. This, you know, we know the prognostic significance of different patterns of mesothelioma with biphasic and sarcomatoid ones behaving worse than the purely epithelioid ones. But what there isn't a lot of data on is correlation between histologic findings and molecular status. And so what these authors did was they took 128 treatment-naive mesothelioma specimens, including a mixture of epithelioid, sarcomatoid, and biphasic ones. And then they did next-generation sequencing and investigated the correlation between mutations and histologic findings. Overall, they saw BAP1 mutations were the most common, and about half of cases had that mutation. About a third of cases had CDKN2A or P16 mutations, and then about a third had NF2 mutations. They saw NF2 alterations more frequently in biphasic mesos. About half of biphasic mesos have that. For whatever reason, they were less commonly seen in sarcomatoid and epithelioid mesos. And then in epithelioid mesos, they saw that TP53 alterations were associated with unfavorable histology. So more frequently seen in tumors with micropapillary or solid architecture or pleomorphic cytology or high nuclear grade. And the last thing they did was look at tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes and TILs. Tumors with a low amount of tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes tended to have BAP1 alterations more commonly than tumors that had lots of tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes, whatever that means. And that's basically the study, that it just, there's some associations between histology and underlying molecular abnormalities, which is, I suppose, of interest to those who are gurus in mesothelioma and molecular stuff. But I sort of leave it at that, since we don't have a whole lot of time left. I don't know if anybody might have any comments in the last 60 seconds.
Did they find any ALK or EWSR1, as in the peritoneal meso, in their NGS?
They make no mention of that. I don't know. I would love to know if there were any. Or if they did, I missed it. Presumably very few if they did, you know, because they're pretty rare. All right. Well, with that, I'll close Journal Club for this month. Appreciate everybody joining. And
let's bid adieu to Dr. Manchin, our fellow last day. Thank you, Pete.
Yes.
We're going to miss you.
Bye, Pete.
Stay in touch, though. So happy Canada Day. Happy 4th of July. Happy whatever you all celebrate.
Yeah, and then I'll be sending out like an updated mechanics and email list probably by next week, early next week. So keep an eye out for that, and then an early schedule, because I will be going on maternity leave like in about a month. So I'm trying to get that out early. So, all right. So see everyone.
Perfect. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.